Hello and welcome to episode 196 of the ASI Cast, our occasional podcast series. I'm John McCarthy and I'm delighted to be joined today on today's podcast by Guy Bisson, who's the Executive Director and co-founder of Ampere Analysis. Welcome, Guy.
Thank you, John.
Your company, Ampere, aims to, and I quote, solve the real-world business challenges in the media and gaming sectors. So, in this episode, we're going to try and consider two such challenges: hyper distribution and ad load, the benefits and the threats of each, and maybe considerations as we move into the second half of 2026. Now, Guy, you spoke at our last conference in Copenhagen, and in the 7 months in between, we've seen partnerships announced with BBC and YouTube in the UK, TF1 and YouTube in France, Atresmedia and Disney Plus in Spain. And at the time of recording, there's speculation around a tie-up between DAZN and DirecTV in Latin America. And that's just four examples. I mean, from your perspective, what's the biggest benefit and the biggest risk of hyper-distribution for both parties?
Yeah, it's a really big question, that one, because it draws in a number of trends that I've been talking about over the last couple of years. One is around what I've been calling diagonal integration, which includes diagonal cooperation, which is effectively legacy players needing to derive growth from non-legacy players, namely streamers and social media companies. And the other is, of course, the bigger picture around audience and audience migration, and the fact that broadcasters, or as we unfortunately tend to call them today, legacy players, are finding it increasingly difficult to sustain their audience and increasingly difficult to reach the young audience at scale. So the benefit for the legacy players is of course, number one, incremental reach, full stop. Number two, reach among that harder to access younger demographic. It is important, though, to say that it's not all a one-way street. The streamers are not doing these deals, and YouTube is not doing these deals out of charity. They're gaining a huge amount from this as well. In the case of a Netflix deal with, say, TF1, for example, which is a full linear carriage deal, they're getting a vast amount of high-value local content that they couldn't possibly hope to produce themselves in that sort of volume and with that sort of local resonance. In the case of YouTube, which increasingly is wanting to be seen as TV, and we've all seen the debates, they are trying to bring the value of the content on their platform up so they can bring the advertising value up to a broadcast like CPM.
Okay, I mean, we'll come back to the content spend maybe in a moment, but given the volume of horizontality we're seeing there across the world, you know, some commentators are saying that, you know, networks and broadcasters are effectively rewriting the rule book. But we've seen this before where, you know, trends or fads have come and gone. Do you think this one is a fad or is it here to stay?
No, it's definitely here to stay. And the reason for that is that distribution, or the primary means of distribution driven by the audience, is becoming streaming. So we're moving from a world in which that, of course, was broadcast, to a world in which streaming is the dominant form of distribution for all entertainment, with the possible exception of the cinema. So that it's only going in one direction. We can't turn back that tide. Broadcasters' problems, legacy broadcasters' problems, are not going away either. This offers them a solution, but of course it comes with significant issues as well. And the primary issue is around control of the end viewer. Incremental distribution is great. It nominally solves all the problems we talked about of audience loss and migration and youth. But when it becomes cannibalistic, on broadcasters' own channels and platforms, then it becomes a problem because the power balance, of course, shifts. In an extreme example, if we said we now live in a world where everyone turned to YouTube or everyone turned to Netflix in order to watch ITV and Channel 4 and the BBC, they have no power, no bargaining power left in the equation. And that would be an extreme example, but it means that their ability to price their own advertising would be impacted. And that, of course, would be detrimental to the entire market, including the investment in content.
Okay, but I mean, you referred there to distribution and the fact that everything is becoming, streaming delivered or delivered via IP. Will that distribution, in terms of the way the scales changing from broadcast or linear to streaming, will that be the critical inflection point, in your opinion, in terms of hyper distribution becoming gaining critical mass, or will it potentially be the inflection point to turn to another model?
I think I wouldn't call it the inflection point. I think it's an important driver of not just this trend that we're talking about now, but basically everything we're seeing happening in the entertainment business right now, from all of the M&A activity to the deals that we're talking about to the change in content strategy. I think the more important thing is the audience, because at the end of the day, that's how any entertainment company monetizes content. We're already at a point where that audience is going in the wrong direction. And I think there will come a point where, and it will be different depending on which country you're in which broadcaster you are, and whether you're commercial or fully public or even a subscription model, will have an impact on when that inflection point comes, but it will be driven by the audience and the migration of that audience primarily to other platforms.
Okay, so if we park distribution form for a moment and look at the actual concept of hyper distribution or horizontality, whilst, as you say, it certainly gained headlines significantly of late, and especially the last year or so, we know it's not universally accepted as the path to progress across the world. I mean, I was participated in something a couple of weeks ago, shortly after the announcement between the BBC and YouTube, where another public service broadcaster in Europe was stated that they would never be adopting a hyper distribution approach, since it's not within their charter and it's not within, what they're about. I mean, in cases like that where, that is not the path for them, who should they be looking to as an example of success? Or, can you point to specific partnerships that are delivering tangible, returns, as you said, the monetizing the audience?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'd point out that even the BBC in its charter review recently said that the economics of YouTube don't work for premium content. So I think they're aware that despite the fact that they've done quite an extensive deal, it's not some sort of golden chalice. It's not going to solve the problems because of the economic imbalance. YouTube was built to support low-cost content. Broadcasters and streamers are built to support high-cost content. When you bring the two together, something breaks, and that's the fundamental problem. I think we're so early, really, in terms of these relationships, that it's very hard to point to one that you can say that's a super success, especially in terms of the revenue contribution, because we just haven't seen the results yet. We're literally a matter of months into most of these deals being done. Obviously, broadcasters have long used YouTube for promotional content, clips, and in the hope that they direct back to the owned channels. But in terms of full linear carriage deals on streamers, that's brand new. Channel 4 has been working with YouTube for a while, putting full-length series on, but they're certainly not done all of their premium content onto that platform yet. So it's a terrible answer for an analyst to give to say time will tell, as we're supposed to have an opinion on everything. But I'm afraid we are very early in this cycle to be able to point to winners. And there are challenges, as I've said, that still need to be resolved. There is a solution, and that is to force a two-tier CPM, a two-tier advertising value, onto YouTube through the way that you control ad sales or through the use of minimum guarantees on your content deals.
In your opinion, what role is audience data playing in those partnerships, or perhaps what role isn't it playing that it should be playing?
Well, as we both know, it's a perennial topic at the ASI conference about multi-screen measurement and cross-platform measurement and where that is currently lacking, and what needs to be done to solve it. And there are a number of companies obviously starting to do that. I think as more and more viewing goes outside of traditional measurement panels, clearly, it's important to try and solve that conundrum and have a unified currency to continue trading ad value. Because effectively, if you're not fully measuring YouTube or you're not fully measuring the Netflix contribution, as more and more content goes onto those platforms and they become important for particularly valuable segments of the population, then lacking audience measurement and lacking accuracy, and having multiple methodologies across that potentially becomes problematic.
You already said that, the content owners themselves are lured by that promise of incremental reach, but at what cost? As you say, once you move beyond the confines of your own owned and operated environment, reach is obviously assured, but the content won't necessarily monetize at the same rate, surely.
Yes, exactly. That's the problem. If we think about YouTube, that's very clear. And as I said, the BBC itself, despite doing a massive deal, has said the economics don't work. Less so potentially for deals with Netflix, Amazon, Disney, etc., because their value of advertising is similar to broadcast television. So nominally, that throws the favor towards those platforms that have a similar CPM, a similar ad value, because you're not devaluing the content. You've not got that issue I described earlier, where you're trying to monetize premium content on a platform designed for very low cost content. So that will be an ongoing issue that broadcasters and others have to consider when they're looking at their distribution strategies. And I don't think that's going to go away very quickly. But as I said earlier, I think there are solutions that can be used with YouTube to bring that value up.
Okay. I mean, obviously, to drive the value anyway across platforms, many would say that you need content. That's what audiences come to whatever platform for. If we see this hyper distribution strategy in the future continuing to scale and be continuing to become the standard, what do you believe? Will this help or will this hinder content commissioning?
Well, if the economics break, it will clearly hinder, and that's why it's essential to find a way to effectively create a ad value that is based on the value of content. So, i.e., to have a two-tier CPM on platforms that are designed for low-value content. Otherwise, of course, the bottom drops out of the content market, and the ability to fund and spend on premium content is damaged significantly. So we're in the early days. People are finding their feet, they're experimenting, they're seeing what works and what doesn't. No one to date has fully solved the money side of it, and it's always absent in the conversations that you see from the YouTube evangelists. But it's the key to making these partnerships work. I think it is specific to social media partnerships. I think the issue largely disappears when you're doing deals with a Netflix or a Disney, who are themselves premium platforms designed for premium content.
in a cross-platform, cross-distribution model is a consolidated view of audiences, of programming to quantify success, a necessity, and before that model reaches a critical mass.
Yeah, I think it is. As we all know, that it's audience measurement is at the center of the value that is attributed to advertising. And for a very long time, there have been issues around measuring the return on investment from in inverted commas, alternative means of advertising, under which I'm including social media. And now, increasingly, that will be streaming SVOD, Netflix-like platforms. So, yes, a single or a universal way and a standardized way of attributing value, especially as advertising now increasingly drives the growth that we are seeing in the television market, because the subscription business, while large and very important, is saturated and is leveling out. So growth is coming from advertising. Channels, content owners are going towards this hyper distribution model, and you need to measure where that audience is coming from and where the ad value is coming from, in order to continue to support and justify these relationships.
Well, clearly, but also obviously to justify the volume of spend that the content creators or the content commissioners are spending. I mean, your own Ampere forecasts, I saw predicted that spend last year was around $248 billion, with streaming platforms outspending commercial broadcasters. I mean, in the US alone, that's been a trend for some time. I suppose with a view to the US in particular, what's driving that and what's the key learnings for those outside the US, do you feel?
Yeah, I mean, we can single out the US, but I think it actually does apply pretty much universally. And it's simply about coming back to almost the first point we talked about, which is audience and where they're choosing to watch their content. And that is increasingly not on linear television, but is on streaming. So the economics follow the amount that the platforms are willing to invest in content follows. Streaming also still has a decent amount of headroom for growth outside of the Western markets, where it's not so saturated. So we're seeing all sorts of different underlying trends here around where that spend is going. Obviously, Asia being a strong growth area, we've seen some swing back from the streamers to North America, following Trump's election and the Make Hollywood Great Again tariff threats. And what we're seeing among the public broadcasters and the commercial linear broadcasters is that they are dropping their rates of commissioning. Now, it's important to say they are still hugely important, especially in Europe, and still massive commissioners of content. But again, it's one of these things that I'm afraid is only going in one direction, and that direction is not upward. Whereas the streamers are still continuing to spend, continuing to grow the amount they spend. Importantly, not necessarily the volume, because there's also another underlying trend of inflation in cost of production that is meaning that the volume doesn't always keep up with the spend growth. But nonetheless, the axis of power has fundamentally shifted towards streaming.
Right. So let me come back to the US if that's okay, because if the power, is moving to streaming as a form of distribution, so too clearly is the one would feel the volume of advertising that's also available on those platforms, notwithstanding the fact that subscription is still a huge volume of the business there. You and I actually met up shortly after your presentation in Copenhagen, where you shone a light for me on your tracker, which monitors ad load by streaming network or platform. And as I recall, there was some very interesting trends that you were seeing in the US in terms of ad load. Can you share with us some of that and with our listeners, and maybe what it's looking like now we're coming reaching the halfway point of 2026?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the first thing to say is that ad revenue for the streamers is growing strongly, but obviously is still well below the broadcast market. It's getting up there. But in terms of the ad load, there's a lot of interesting trends to unpack there. You can almost divide streamers into three fundamental groups. And you've got what I would call the broadcast legacy streamers, so the streamers that own network television channels in the US who have the highest ad loads at the moment on their streaming platforms. A number of reasons for that. They were obviously already well established in ad sales, they had all the relationships, etc. And they have an attitude towards advertising that is high volume of advertising. They're at around 10, 11 minutes of ads per hour on their streaming platform. So the likes of Hulu, Disney Plus, Paramount Plus. At the other extreme, you've got Netflix, which has the lowest ad load of any of the streamers, incredibly low ad load at 2 minutes. And then in the middle, you've got the likes of Amazon, Tubi, Pluto, 4, 5, 6 minutes per hour. We did see a fairly rapid increase on Amazon that has dropped back a little bit over the last few months. But it's clear that they are all, and from the unfilled inventory that we can see, so fill rates are, again, it varies, but they range between 50 to 80%. Of inventory is actually sold, so there's more headroom to grow. Clearly, all of them are going to gradually increase that ad load. The interesting one, I think, actually is Netflix, because Netflix needs to increase its ad load to bring the value of its ad tier customers up. They're currently worth about half what a premium customer is worth. And clearly, as more and more people take the ad tier, that's not great. However, another thing that we're picking up on is, and advertisers are going to cry into their breakfast, but it's the value of low ad loads. So, network TV, I think I've said on podcasts in the past, network TV in the US for me is unwatchable, with 16 to 18 minutes of ads per hour. There is value in having a very low ad load. Obviously, audience engagement is higher. The break in attention is lower, and advertisers value being part of a sort of exclusive club, because if you're one of, 2 minutes an hour, we're talking about four ads in an hour. And if you're one of those four, clearly, you value that over being one of 20. It's all about balance. It's all about other factors that are harder to quantify, like the goodwill around the platform for the audience, the engagement of the audience, the value they place on that brand and that platform. So there are, again, a lot of moving parts that are impacting this, but I think it's a really interesting discussion around the value of having advertising, but not having much advertising.
And you started the week at Cannes discussing the future of entertainment. And I know there was a number of studio commissioning editors and investors and financiers present there in Cannes. Kind of to close, what was your biggest takeout from the conversations that you had there that could perhaps inform our listeners and the wider ASI community?
Well, I'm going to apologize, I think, because I'm going to give an answer that's a bit of a cop out, but I think it's actually something that fundamentally is what we've all been talking about for the last 6, 12 months, and that is that we are at a point in the industry. We're at one of these points that occurs every 15, 20, 30 years, where we're on the cusp of a massive change. And nobody quite knows where we're going to end up in 12, 24 months. And I think there's a realization in the industry that we are in this place and we are at that point, and there's a lot of uncertainty, and everyone's aware of, what we've been talking about, the deals that are being done, the M&A, the partnerships, the new versus old distribution platforms, the value that is placed on content and advertising. And everyone's really running around a bit like a headless chicken, wondering where this is all going to end. And I think that was probably the key takeaway.
Okay. Uncertainty, but lots to keep everyone busy for the next 12 to 18 months for sure.
Never
Great
a
time to
dull
be an
moment.
investor.
Yeah, never a dull moment in this industry, that's for sure.
And lots for us to unpack and explore as we plan for our 2026 conferences in Venice, and more on that to follow. Well, Guy, thank you very much for your time, and thanks for sharing your perspective and the latest trends you're seeing. We look forward to welcome you on a podcast very soon.
Great. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Guy.